Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live with part two.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good and excited for part two because it was a cliffhanger.
It was.
And you've also been doing a lot of research.
Yes.
And we've seen the movie.
We have. We have now seen the movie that was based off of this story. And that was a trip.
It was. Star-studded cast.
Yeah. Mark Wahlberg, The Rock. Really something.
Yeah. So I wonder how much they paid them, but it was... I don't know. It had the vibe of Ocean's 11 or some kind of heist movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess I just didn't go into the movie expecting that. So it was a little odd, but, you know.
Yeah, it does make sense that it was kind of framed that way. You know, I mean, they're bodybuilders wearing ninja costumes and going to spy shops, so.
Yeah, you're right.
But I will say, and we will talk about it later, but it left a bit of a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah,
because because they kind of treated this whole thing like it was a comedy. And like, yes, I can understand and like agree with that. There are so many parts of this story that are very ridiculous and like sounds like you're watching a ridiculous movie. But also like these were real people and they kind of made very light of this whole situation, which I, you know, could critique, I feel like. Anyway, we could talk about it more later. But for now, why don't we jump into part two?
Let's do it.
So where we left off, Mark Schiller had just left the hospital, gone to Columbia, and escaped Miami.
Yeah, narrowly escaping another murder attempt by 2 hours?
Yes, yeah. He left the hospital at 8 a.m. and the gang was at the hospital to kill him at 10 a.m. So yes, 2 hours. So about a month later, after recovering from massive injuries at Jackson Memorial Hospital, Mark Schiller called private investigator Ed Dubois once again. Do you remember him?
No. Can you remind me who he is?
Yes. So while Mark Schiller was at the hospital, his lawyer advised him to call Ed Dubois, who was a private investigator, basically to see if he could help him with this gang. And he called him and told him his whole story about how he had been kidnapped and tortured and had an attempted murder, done to him, basically. And Ed Dubois basically advised him to leave Miami. He said, you can go anywhere you want, just get the hell out of here. And then he's like, I'm not going to take your case. I'm sorry. And then he hung up the phone. So that's Ed Dubois' role thus far. But now that he's in Colombia, he called Ed Dubois once again. For weeks, Schiller said he'd been chained to a wall and tortured in unspeakable ways. He'd been forced to sign away his house, his investments, his bank accounts, his life insurance. In the end, the kidnappers tried to kill him, and they nearly succeeded. Although blindfolded during the ordeal, he recognized one of his captors, a former business partner and protege, George Delgado. And he recognized the voice of Danny Lugo. But now he wanted his house back. He needed his money. But most important, he wanted to make sure that they wouldn't find him and finish the job. Oh, for clarification's sake, at where I'm at in the story, he's currently in New York.
Okay.
But he does end up in Columbia. But we went back in time a little bit.
Right. So he helicoptered from Miami to New York.
Yes. And he's staying with his sister in New York. Okay, so Mark Schiller spent the next week recovering at Staten Island University Hospital. On Christmas Eve 1994, he left the hospital and moved into his sister's Long Island home. He couldn't get across the room without using a walker. And simple things like emptying his bladder was agony. But he could remember nearly everything that happened to him the month before. The burns and the beatings, the forced signatures, and the attempted murder. Most importantly, he remembered the betrayal by George Delgado, whom he had hired and made rich through generous partnerships. He called his brother, Alex Schiller, who lived in Tampa, and Alex called Delgado. Alex knew every disgusting detail of the abduction, and he knew Delgado and his buddies had swindled Mark out of various assets. He knew about the torture, and he was coming to Miami to avenge that suffering. Delgado had better grow eyes in the back of his head. This was a new problem for the Sun Gym gang. Schiller was clearly alive and talking, so they'd have to eliminate him once and for all. So on Christmas Eve, Daniel Lugo, Adrian Dorball, and Stevenson Pierre made a journey to Tampa. They assumed Schiller must be staying at his brother's house, and so this time they'd kill him with no screw-ups. But as they watched the house, Alex emerged with a suitcase and took off in his car for Miami to come get them. The three men lost him on the Florida Turnpike, so Lugo called ahead to warn Delgado, who spent a paranoid Christmas at home with his family and their new baby. Lugo and Dorball had been making pretty regular visits to Schiller's old Cutler Cove home since mid-November, when they'd ordered their captive to tell his wife to grab the children and flee to her native Colombia. Among the first possessions the gang removed from the vacated house were the contents of the safe, which was $10,000 in cash plus credit cards, the deed to the house, and documents pertaining to Schiller's condominium, insurance papers, and his wife's jewelry. By early January 1995, the gang was inspired once again. They hadn't heard from Schiller or his brother and decided it was safe to move into the house, which they definitely wanted to do. It was a very swanky upscale place, complete with a swimming pool, jacuzzi, and an entertainment system that featured a 50-inch television. They'd taken care of the paperwork, and now the house belonged to D&J International, a company out of the Bahamas that Lugo had set up the year before. They'd netted about $2.1 million in cash, real estate, cars, credit cards, and jewels. Lugo, who still had to worry about the constraining terms of his federal probation, leased an $80,000 gold Mercedes in Delgado's name. Because if we remember, Lugo still owes $70,000 to his previous victims, and so he can't really have like big sums of money just like to his name.
Right.
Carl Weeks, the unemployed New York welfare recipient who'd moved to Miami to clean up his act, received about half the promised $100,000 payment for his role in the kidnapping. Stevenson Pierre received about $30,000.
What?
Yeah. So,
wow.
They apparently said he had an attitude problem, and they decided that he had been absent during the most crucial parts of the abduction, torture, and attempted murder, so he only deserved $30,000. The night that they tried the night that they tried to kill Schiller, he was not there. So,
okay, I mean, I'm just laughing because my knee-jerk reaction is be like, yeah, you should give him more, but like it's like this is not
underpaid.
This is not the, yeah, this
overworked.
Is not...
Yeah. Lugo was the main face that was seen around Schiller's home and neighborhood. He introduced himself around the neighborhood as Tom and explained that he and his colleagues were members of the U.S. security forces. Mark Schiller had run into legal trouble and had been deported, along with his family. The house had been confiscated and was now government property. Tom and his crew would take care of its maintenance, and any strangers seen coming and going would be foreign diplomats, most of them from the Caribbean. From the Caribbean. What's the Caribbean? Caribbean. Pirates of the Caribbean.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I would say Caribbean.
Okay, great. I would too, but I said it wrong. Okay, most of them would be from the Caribbean, which is funny because it's just a bunch of bodybuilders. They're like, anyone you see is a foreign diplomat. Don't even think twice about it.
If you see a mountains of men coming in and out,
don't think twice.
Who just look like Chad.
Right. And this wasn't a one-time introduction and explanation. The gang was very neighborly and would even borrow tools from their neighbors and return them very promptly. Tom, which was Lugo, helped one of his neighbors by climbing up a tall ladder to change a front porch light bulb two stories above their welcome mat. They started paying HOA fees, and he asked another neighbor to accept deliveries or packages delivered to the Schiller house if no one was home. This neighbor accepted 12 UPS deliveries and handed them over with no question.
Wow. It is amazing that everyone just accepted this kind of outlandish story.
Yeah, they didn't really ask much. And also, like, Lugo was pretty charismatic. And so
yeah, I'm sure.
They were like, great. Happy to have you here, new neighbor. You know?
Yeah, I'm just saying it's crazy how far one guy can get.
Yes. Oh, my God. Lugo had once again visited the spy shop that they went to before kidnapping Schiller, but this time it was to upgrade Schiller's home security system. He decided on a $7,000 closed-circuit video surveillance package that included waterproof outdoor cameras and sensors and had a 25-inch monitor installed inside the main living room. He hired gardeners to add shrubs and dense plants and flowers to the front, and over time, their new place was becoming a home. Weeks even began sleeping over for days at a time, and sometimes Dorval stayed as well. So they were just having big bodybuilder sleepovers at their stolen mansion. But they had to keep up their appearances in their real lives as well. So the whole time, Lugo and the others were still going to work at the Sun Gym. And after work, they'd very frequently head to Solid Gold, which was a strip club in North Miami Beach. Dorval had his eyes set on the very beautiful Beatrice Weiland, a Hungarian stripper. Lugo was also very interested in one of the women at the club, Sabina Petrescu, a 25-year-old dancer and model for Penthouse. In 1990, she scored runner-up in the Miss Romania contest and now longed for life as an actress in the West. She wanted the American dream. She flew from Bucharest to Moscow, to Havana, to Mexico City, before entering the United States in the trunk of a car. She worked as a cocktail waitress in San Diego until a talent scout approached her about modeling gigs in Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and New York, and the assignments had all required Sabina to remove her clothes, usually while she danced on stage, and so eventually she wound up in Miami. Lugo and Dorval definitely had the physique and personalities to entice these women. Both of them, as we know, had massive muscles. Lugo had a broad forehead, a brilliant smile, and dark, stubbled jaw. He possessed tremendous charm and a great deal of money, $1 million already from the Medicare fraud scheme, and now all of Schiller's assets. Although Dorval was shorter than Lugo, he sported a thick head of wavy black hair that fell almost to his waist, and was described as resembling some kind of carved Caribbean fertility god.
Fair enough.
On Super Bowl Sunday, Beatrice told Sabina that they were going to dance in the champagne room since there was someone there who wanted to meet her. The champagne room was upstairs in the club where the really big spenders would go, usually pro athletes, drug dealers, tourist businessmen, mobsters, and B-list actors who were surrounded by several girls. You could buy a whole bottle of champagne for $1,000. Guys who wanted to show off burned $10,000 in an evening very easily. Now Lugo was the one who was up there, and he wanted to talk to Sabina. He told her he was in the music business, and he wanted to feature her in a video that he would be filming in London. As the conversation progressed, he periodically handed her 20s. And by the end of the night, they had kissed, which sparked their relationship. Within a week, they were dating. By February, he had her put up in a one-bedroom, $800 per month townhouse apartment that overlooked Main Street in Miami Lakes, which I'm sure at the time was a very pricey apartment. But nowadays,
$800
is a very good price.
Unheard of.
Yeah. Sabina wouldn't have to dance naked anymore. He could take care of her. And in the years since the divorce, he said he had never felt so close to a woman, so they began living together. And that was convenient for Lugo because he could drive just a few miles and be back home with his pregnant wife, Lucretia Goodridge. So, you know, he's fully cheating on Lucretia. At first, everything went very well for the new couple, but after some time, Sabina started to question Lugo's odd behaviors and odd hours. Why would a music video producer need night vision binoculars? And what was happening with the music video in London that he had promised her? She was getting bored, and she wanted answers. So Lugo gave her an answer. He told her if their relationship was going to work, she needed to understand his work. He worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, or the CIA. He'd gone through some really harrowing missions that left him almost dead. He told her stories about missions he had to go on in Hong Kong, where he had to live in a tree for a week, or how in London the company had left him on his own to survive on the leftovers from room service trays. He had plenty of stories to tell her of his time in the CIA. And after spilling the beans to Sabina, he swore her to secrecy. Sabina loved this and totally believed him. She was living out her very own American action movie, like James Bond, and he even gave her a special code for her beeper. If she saw 007, she knew to call Lugo.
This is so over the... I mean, everything comes back to the CIA. He's just like... It's really working for him.
I'm not a criminal. I'm a secret agent.
I'm a secret agent.
Sabina ate it up.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly worked, but I don't know. It's so ridiculous, and I have to imagine that the word CIA or secret agent distracted from all of the inconsistent details that had to be there.
Oh, yeah, because anything that she had a question about or something that was, like, odd behavior, he could just make up an excuse, and he was pretty quick on his feet to, like, have an explanation.
He kind of feels like, or I think that in the right situation, he would have been a cult leader.
Oh, sure.
For sure.
Yeah, I think with his personality, he probably could have done that if he really set his mind to it. But it doesn't sound like he wants to have a cult. He just wants to have millions of dollars. So yeah. A gang of bodybuilders will have to do for now.
Yeah.
Adrian Dorbal had also moved nearby in a two-story townhouse apartment a block away on Main Street, which made complete sense because Dorbal was also in the CIA. And when the guys disappeared for a few days now and then, it was because they were constantly on call. They had to report to headquarters in Langley, Virginia at a moment's notice. Dorbal had been dating a nurse named Cindy Eldridge. She was a blonde fitness enthusiast who liked fast cars and had a red Corvette. Dorbal had proposed to her, but she declined because they didn't know each other very well, and she didn't even live in the city. Most of their dates had been between Schiller's torture at the warehouse, and it was all too soon for her. But in winter of 1995, Cindy wanted to move to Miami so they would have more time together. But that was a problem because Dorbal was now living down the street from Lugo's girlfriend, who thought that he was a CIA agent. Dorbal had also been experiencing pretty major mood swings and impotence, which were symptoms of his continuous steroid use. And this was apparently just an occupational hazard for bodybuilders, so it wasn't that shocking. But because of all of this, Dorbal broke things off with Cindy. So while the bodybuilders were playing house and pretending to be CIA agents, Mark Schiller and Ed Dubois had begun working together officially. Ed Dubois was very happy to hear that Mark Schiller was safe and healing after this whole terrifying ordeal. Schiller was on his way to Colombia to be with his family, but he wanted to hire a detective to look into his kidnapping. So Dubois told him to write down everything he could remember about his abduction and torture and send any documentation that he could gather. A few days later, Schiller flew to Colombia. He was still on crutches and was a mess physically and mentally. He had lost 40 pounds and was down to 120 pounds. He had nightmares of that helpless, horrific month in the warehouse. He'd erupt in crying fits in the middle of everyday events, and he needed desperately to piece his life back together. Every day, he'd learn about a new $80,000 charge made to his credit card. His Schlotsky's Deli franchise had been dissolved. The house now belonged to a Nassau, Bahama corporation he knew nothing about. His offshore accounts, in which he'd kept $1.26 million in investments, had been cleaned out, and his checking account was empty.
So he literally had nothing left?
Nothing. They cleared every single thing.
Wow.
Yeah. He began compiling documents that followed the transfers of his property to mysterious offshore companies and people he had never met. There had also been the MetLife change of beneficiary policy, which actually made him laugh. Yes, his signature was on the form, but it didn't even run along the line on the page. It was completely sideways, running up and down the form over the words. And several other documents had the same strange signature. He couldn't believe his bank was honoring them. He also had no idea who this Lillian Torres was, whom he'd apparently signed over his $2 million life insurance policy and his investment in a luxury condominium. It was during the Super Bowl week that Schiller's letter arrived at Dubois' office, which detailed the brutal ordeal and his certainty that George Delgado, his former business partner and friend, was involved. He also named Daniel Lugo, an associate of Delgado, as one of his captors. Dubois had no idea who most of these people were, but the paper trail seemed to be lining up. He also attached documents to the letter, which were copies of title and account transfers, which had been witnessed and notarized by John Meese, which was shocking to Dubois because he knew John Meese personally. And for those of you who don't remember, John Meese is the owner of the Sun Gym. Schiller was convinced John Meese had to have been involved with his kidnapping, but Dubois was having a very hard time believing that. Dubois knew him as an accountant, a former bodybuilder, the owner of Sun Gym, and a promoter of bodybuilding competitions. He'd known Meese and his family for 30 years through the Miami Shores Country Club and the Kiwanis Club. In fact, Meese occasionally used his detective agency. The two men were similar in the Miami Shores community. Both had attended Miami Edison Senior High School. Both were handsome, strong, hardworking, and prosperous. They had pretty wives and wholesome kids, and for 5 years in the 70s, they'd had offices across the street from each other in the Shores Business District. Dubois couldn't believe he was part of this. If anything, he thought Meese was a decent, harmless guy whose true passion, bodybuilding, sometimes intruded on his day job. Lugo had a document notarized by Meese, which legally means that Meese had to witness Schiller signing the document. But Dubois thought he must have been conned because the only way he could have witnessed it would have been if he were in the warehouse while Schiller was being tortured. Dubois called Meese and asked for a meeting. The meeting took place on February 2nd, 1995 at Meese's Miami Shores office. Meese told Dubois that he had never known anyone named Mark Schiller. Dubois wanted to know, did he know George Delgado and Daniel Lugo? And to the detective's surprise, Meese said yes. Lugo was employed at his gym, and Delgado worked out there. Besides that, they were hardworking businessmen and clients of his. He'd represented both before the IRS. And Meese seemed confused. He didn't know how he fit into this weird story. Dubois handed him a copy of the quitclaim deed to Schiller's house and Schiller's MetLife change of beneficiary form, which were both notarized by John Meese. It was millions in Schiller's assets, and Meese's name was on it. Suddenly, he knew something about these documents. He told Dubois, "Actually, Lugo and Delgado brought in some Latin guy with a fake passport for an ID. Maybe that's what happened." Dubois asked, "Was there a woman with him?" And Meese said no, which again was a problem because Diana Schiller had quote-unquote signed this deed over, which was odd because she had left the U.S. on November 18th and her signature appeared on the document dated on November 23rd and 24th. So Meese began to sweat a little bit and he hesitated and said that he couldn't really recall how that happened. It could have been signed before he received the papers or something weird happened. He couldn't really be sure. But he agreed to set up a meeting with Lugo and Delgado to figure it out.
How does he think that he's going to get out of this? Like, you better leave the country.
That's one way to do it. But he's like fully a business owner and has a million different, you know, business ventures going on.
Yeah. Start over in Colombia.
Oh, God. Yeah. Maybe don't randomly pick Colombia because Mark Schiller needs a break.
Yeah, for sure. Argentina.
Sure. Go to Argentina.
Start a wine business. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, he's definitely starting to sweat. That's for sure. So the second meeting was set up for February 13th, again at Meese's office. And this time Dubois brought a bodyguard and told his best friend, Ed O'Donnell, a veteran criminal lawyer, where he was going, the circumstances, and everything. So if something did happen to him, someone knew. If Lugo and Delgado had committed terrible crimes against Schiller, they were capable of anything. Delgado arrived alone, and Dubois quickly sized him up. He didn't seem too threatening. Delgado asked to see Schiller's letter, as well as the house deed and the change of beneficiary form. He took his time inspecting them before handing the papers back to Dubois. He told Dubois, "This is all over a business deal," as if he were dismissing the matter and there was nothing more to say, which rubbed Dubois the wrong way. Dubois asked, "Well, is it customary in your business deals to kidnap someone and keep them hostage for a month, beat them, torture them, and try to kill them and blow them up?" And Delgado said, "I'm not going to comment on that." Dubois jabbed a thick index finger in Delgado's face and said, "It finally dawned on me as to what really happened here. Had you killed Mark Schiller that night as you had intended, this would have been a perfect crime. You had his cash, property, cars, home, plus a $2 million bonus if he died. You had his family leave the country, him playing the role about a young girl and a midlife crisis. You had his phone calls diverted from his home to the warehouse where you had him chained to a wall." And Delgado didn't say anything. "If he died, you would have been successful. But guess what, asshole? Schiller is alive and well, and we are going to put your ass in jail." These are quotes.
Dude, I mean, I'm sure he has years and years of experience. To me, this sounds really bold. That you're going to go right up to the person who did all that shit or co-signed it in any way, and you're just going to put your finger in their face and say you know everything.
It's a big move.
I don't know.
It was.
Seems risky.
Definitely. It was a dangerous move, which he knew because he brought a bodyguard. So there's that.
Oh, okay. I didn't know he brought a bodyguard. I thought he just told the criminal defense attorney.
No, he told the defense attorney, and also he brought a bodyguard because he knew that they were bodybuilders who had kidnapped and tortured a man. So,
yeah, I would have maybe brought two or three.
Yeah. But he wanted them to know that he knew and that he that Mark Schiller was alive and this was not going to go away.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a power move. Mies rejoined the discussion, and Delgado went suddenly quiet and seemed to want out of the room very fast. So he suggested another meeting. He said that he would bring Lugo in tomorrow to explain the whole situation, and they would meet at Mies' branch office in Miami Lakes. The next day, Dubois showed up, but Mies was late, and neither Delgado or Lugo were there. When Mies finally did show up, he seemed surprised to see Dubois, saying, "Gee, Ed, what are you doing here?" And Dubois was not buying this act and could see that Mies was sweating. He said, "We had a meeting scheduled at 9 o'clock. Remember, we set it up yesterday. Where are Lugo and Delgado?" And Mies told him that they should be on their way. But in the meantime, he could go over his client files from the Sun Gym and look through whatever. So he escorted Dubois and his bodyguard to a vacant room and sat him at a cluttered desk with an overflowing ashtray and two champagne glasses stained with the sweet residue of whatever drink was inside. The files were unhelpful and boring, but what Dubois did find was discarded paper in the trash that referenced the Sun Gym and the Schiller abduction suspects, and it linked Mies to it as well. Mies had kind of unintentionally ushered Dubois into Lugo's office, where the gang had actually planned Schiller's kidnapping, and glancing at the champagne glasses and the ashtray, Dubois believed that two people had been up all night throwing this stuff away and had assumed that a cleaning crew would have gotten there before any other person would have. So he literally just found a bunch of damning documents and stuff in the trash in Lugo's office.
Wow.
Where Mies put him. Like,
it's so funny.
I know.
Shit just happens. I mean, it sounds like he would have gotten it anyway.
Yeah.
But this is really helpful.
Yes. It's very good. This very damning evidence that he found showed that in January of 1995, the Sun Gym had written various checks totaling $163,969. And so he thought to himself, how does the Sun Gym blow through almost 200 grand in a month?
A lot of upgrades and investments.
Yeah, a lot of gym equipment.
Cash only gym equipment. Yeah, a lot of clients paying in cash. I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't
so,
ask about it.
Like I said earlier, 30 grand of that alone went to Carl Weeks, and the U.S. government also received a portion of it because a cashier's check was written for $67,845 to pay off Lugo's court-ordered restitution from his fraud conviction. So he did end up paying back his victims, but with Schiller's money.
Yeah.
Lugo still was on parole and couldn't possibly explain the sudden 70 grand from the Sun Gym, so his boss had purchased the cashier's check, and Mies attached a letter stating that he'd paid that much for a software program Lugo created for the gym, and through old-fashioned money laundering, they moved the funds from Schiller's Cayman Islands offshore accounts to Sun Fitness Consultants to Mies' Sun Gym account to Central Bank, where Mies and Associates had an operational account where Mies bought the cashier's check. So it was a lot of moving of funds before it could actually go to Lugo, but they did it.
That's fun.
And it was all with John Mies' help, so his hands were not clean in this stuff. At last, George Delgado showed up alone, and Dubois, thanks to Mies' colossal mistake, launched into his list of accusations, kind of once again. Delgado stopped him and said they weren't going to talk about it anymore because they were going to give Schiller's money back, the $1 million, which it was more than $1 million, but still, that's what he said. And that sounded like a pretty sweet confession to Dubois. The return, however, was conditional, Delgado explained. First, Dubois and Schiller would have to sign an agreement that they'd never repeat the story to anyone, certainly not the police. And then, and only then, Schiller would see the $1.26 million from the offshore accounts he'd signed over. So the detective agreed to talk to his client. And with that, the meeting was over. Even if they could figure that out and get Schiller his money back, Dubois knew that this would never be over until the men were behind bars. He knew with certainty that they would do it again to someone else, and the next time, they would make damn sure to kill the person. That evening, as a Valentine's Day present, Lugo presented Sabina with an engagement ring and $1,000 in her bank account. And he gave her some good news. They were going to take some time off and go to Orlando to celebrate the end of his federal probation. Lugo had begun to get a little bit worried because he had received a call from Lillian Torres. She was the one who had the $2 million MetLife change of beneficiary form signed over to her, and she told him that an investigator from Dubois' office had shown up on her doorstep asking nosy questions, and they'd made the connection, which was hardly a stretch, between her and Lugo, because that was his ex-wife, and so it was pretty clear. So he started to wonder how long it would take for them to reach his current wife, Lucretia Goodridge, who, if we remember, had witnessed Schiller in captivity. So by now, Dubois had laid out the gang's proposition to Schiller, but he wasn't impressed. In fact, he thought the offer was no more than a stall tactic while they tried to find him. He had no doubts that they would kill him if they found him. On the other hand, he was desperate for cash and he wanted to go to the cops, but what if he could get the money and then go to the police? That way, when the guys were arrested, he wouldn't have to watch them use his money to pay off their lawyers. They also wondered if the gang would even be able to get a lawyer willing to help them, but they actually did. Joel Greenberg, who was a plantation attorney in his first year of practice. Lugo's plan was to alter the contract to read $1.26 million liar instead of $1.26 million, meaning that he would have to pay Schiller like $1,200 instead of $1.26 million.
Liar?
It's the basic monetary unit of Italy or of Turkey. I don't know. It's a
foreign currency.
It's a foreign currency, but it would basically mean that they would only have to pay him $1,200 instead of $1.26 million.
It's like even in his bribes, he's trying to cut corners.
Yes, of course. He doesn't want to give the money back.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. But so the days dragged on and drafts of the contract were faxed between the two camps. Schiller agreed to every new revision, but there was no money coming in. So Dubois sent Greenberg a letter to warn him that unless the funds were forthcoming, he would deliver the Sun Gang a civil RICO complaint so large he would have to deliver it in a U-Haul. Which is a Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act complaint. It basically provides compensation to individuals or businesses who have been harmed by a pattern of corruption or racketeering activity.
Is this not the same laws that brought the mob down?
I have no idea.
I'm really doing a lot of...
You're making wide claims. Yeah. So with these legal threats heating up, the gang decided that it was time to get out with what they could. So they cleared out Schiller's home. They hired a few weightlifters from the Sun Gym to help them, quote unquote, move out, and they completely gutted Schiller's home before they left, including a 50-inch Mitsubishi television, Persian rugs, bronze sculptures, leather couches, bedroom furnishings, silver, crystal, the dining table, an $8,000 buffet, the washer and dryer, a freezer, computers and video games, all the paintings and decor, copiers and a printer, assorted camcorders, a smaller TV, patio furniture, jacuzzi, two bicycles, a baby stroller, and a faux Christmas tree, and even the family photo albums and videos.
Really, guys?
Which is just like a...
knife in the back.
Yeah, that's messed up. You can take the jacuzzi, even though that hurts me. Leave the photo album. You don't care about that shit. Are you
crazy?
Leave
Aunt Janice.
Seriously. They also took Schiller's favorite snakeskin briefcase and his $600 Cartier sunglasses, Diana's Gucci's, all the kids' clothes. Like, just so, they literally were like, we're going to clear him out completely. So think about literally every speck of dust in every corner of that mansion they took. They also stole Diana's BMW station wagon and had all of the car's vehicle identification changed. When Schiller won back the title to his house, Dubois had to tell him that the gang took literally everything but the fridge and the baby food inside. Some of the things went to Delgado's warehouse, where they tortured Schiller, and some went straight to Lugo's apartment and the other guys' places. Like, they just took it all and started using it as their own. Negotiations for the return of Schiller's $1.26 million had gone nowhere. He still hadn't seen a dime. And so Dubois had to finally admit that his client was right. Lugo and Delgado never planned to return the money, and so now it was time to go to the police. Dubois called Metro-Dade homicide captain Al Harper, who was also one of his acquaintances and a 27-year veteran of the police department. And after Harper heard the horrific story, he called Metro's Elite Strategic Investigations Division. SID conducted all major investigations involving fraud, drug trafficking, contract killing, criminal conspiracy, and organized crime. And so Dubois' next contact was through SID, which was Detective Kevin Long. He didn't launch into every detail at the start because he wanted to establish Schiller as a credible victim, so they decided to do a polygraph with him to demonstrate that Schiller's story was weird, but he was telling the truth. Detective Long said, sure, he'd take the case, but Schiller needed to agree to come back to Miami to speak with him and, you know, do the polygraph. And Schiller agreed, but he was still afraid for his life, so he wanted to make the trip very short. On Tuesday morning, April 18th, Schiller flew into Miami from Columbia and checked into the Miami International Airport Hotel under a fake name. He brought along a Colombian relative for protection. It was the first time Schiller and Dubois had met in person. At the SID office, they were met by Sergeant Gary Porterfield, who asked Schiller to wait outside as he talked with Dubois in his office. Dubois laid everything out and showed all of the information he had gathered on Daniel Lugo, Adrian Durbal, George Delgado, and the Sun Gym owner, John Meese. He also knew others had been involved and was positive that they would be easy to track down and question. He also gave Porterfield a 20-page memo and canceled checks, deed transfers, accident reports, hospital records, and had a copy of Lugo's federal rap sheet and divorce documents. Schiller then gave his statement, and a polygraph was scheduled for Thursday, and then rescheduled for Friday. Schiller was already staying in Miami longer than he planned, but this was important. On Friday, when they showed up for Schiller's polygraph, Sergeant Porterfield gave them some bad news. SID wasn't going to take the case. Instead, they would pass it along to the Robbery Bureau. Dubois was dumbfounded. How could they pass this complex and nasty of a case to robbery, who was already dealing with like 10,000 purse snatchings? He knew they were basically throwing out the case. Porterfield said his supervisor, Lieutenant Ed Pito, had concluded that the basic elements of this case were robbery. This was bad not only for Schiller, who would still not be able to get his money back, but also the gang would absolutely snatch and torture someone else once they needed more money. They went to the Miami-Dade robbery unit, and they didn't really believe him either. They had been forewarned to look out for Schiller's quote-unquote Academy Award-winning performance. So these police officers are like, this man is completely lying, and we don't want this case, so we're kind of just passing it along, but like, he's lying, so you can pass on it too.
Are they not considering any of the evidence?
Not really, it didn't seem like it.
That's crazy. I mean, he has so much.
Yeah. Schiller was in shock. He might have expected skepticism from his State Farm claims agent, but not from the police. The police felt like, why had he waited 4 months after the alleged crime to make a complaint? Why had he agreed to financial settlement before coming to the police? And his tale was just so bizarre that it was like something you read out of a book. So they just didn't believe him. They asked if he would be willing to take a polygraph. And Schiller was like, are you joking? I literally requested one myself. Yes, I'm willing to take a polygraph. And they told him he'd have to wait to take it until the following Tuesday. Schiller had already stayed in Miami much longer than he wanted to, and he had no money to his name, so he thought, to hell with them, he was going home. Dubois was pissed because he'd worked as an outside contractor for the Metro Police hundreds of times and solved capital cases. And now they were treating his client like a joke, and they were running out of time. So he drove Schiller back to his office and called the Miami Bureau of the FBI, but his contact there was out of town. So next he called Fred Taylor, director of the Metro-Dade Police Department, who Dubois knew socially and professionally. The director listened as Dubois detailed their treatment at the robbery bureau and said he'd put in a call to robbery commander Pete Cassaro. Minutes later, Cassaro was on the line assuring the detective that he had his best people on the job, Deegan and Mayer. And Dubois couldn't help but roll his eyes. Thankfully, the same day Schiller left for his flight back to Columbia, Detective Iris Deegan decided that she would take a look into things. She paid a visit to Schiller's old home and saw the house appeared to be abandoned. When she interviewed neighbors, they were able to identify Lugo and said yes, they'd accepted UPS deliveries for him, even though the packages were addressed to Mark Schiller. And they said Schiller had disappeared before the previous Thanksgiving. Everything was lining up. After about a week of looking into things, Detective Deegan was convinced something criminal had taken place. She'd subpoenaed Schiller's bank and credit cards and asked American Express for invoices and delivery notices, but then went on to work on other cases, and she never questioned the suspects. And when Dubois found that out, he was pissed. He's like, why are you working on other things? Why aren't you questioning anyone? She's like, don't tell me how to do my job. And that was kind of it.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. And so by now, Dubois had presented his facts and documents to FBI agent Art Wells, a 12-year veteran. And Wells thought, and later said, it's like something you see for a made-for-TV movie. And he chose to not pursue an investigation either. He couldn't figure it out. He had spent 35 years working in Miami assisting the police, and he had never cried wolf. So why wasn't anyone taking this? Since nothing was happening to the gang, they obviously continued to be terrible. And just as Dubois predicted, they were about to move on to their next victim. Lugo and Durbal had set their sights on one of the members of the gym, Winston Lee. They had this whole plan to kidnap and torture him like they had done to Schiller. They were even going to use Sabina to lure him in, telling her that Lee was a terrorist and this was a CIA mission. But the gang abandoned Lee as a target because he had traveled too frequently to Jamaica and couldn't figure out when he'd be home. So they're like, ah, on to the next. Adrian Durbal found their new victim. He had finally scored with Sabina's friend and fellow stripper, Beatrice Weiland. And one day, while looking through one of her photo albums, he had found a picture of a woman lounging in front of a very impressive car. It was Beatrice's mother, and the man who had owned the $250,000 Lamborghini Diablo was a Hungarian man named Frank Griga. He'd been one of Beatrice's lovers, and she still spoke of him affectionately. She told Durbal Griga had achieved fantastic wealth through the phone sex industry, and he was the most generous man that she had ever known. He was born in Berlin in 1961 and was the son of a Hungarian diplomat. He moved to New York City in the mid-80s, where he worked as a car washer, then as a foreign car mechanic, and in 1988, he moved to Miami, where he got a job in sales at a luxury car dealership. But Frank Griga had big dreams. He didn't want to sell those cars. He wanted to own them. He was active in Miami's tiny Hungarian community, and through that joined a group of local investors in the 800 and 900 number phone line markets. From there, he moved on to sex lines, which were much more profitable. His services were advertised in Penthouse and Hustler. Callers spent up to $5 per minute to engage in sexually explicit conversations with telephone actors and actresses. Many Hungarians in Miami thought of him as the Alexander Graham Bell of phone sex. It had earned him a fortune, making $3 million in 1994 alone.
Jesus, that's so much money for, like, I'm just imagining what's happening, like, on the phone, just, like, hundreds and hundreds of times, and he makes $3 million off of it.
Mm-hmm. He was rich, rich.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, think about $3 million in 1994.
Oh, yeah.
Like, $3 million today is a lot of money, but...
Like, $800 a month is a nice, nice apartment downtown.
Right. He owned so many ridiculously expensive cars and yachts and mansions. Like, he was rolling in it. After he and Beatrice had parted ways, she introduced him to Christina Furton at Crazy Horse 2, a Fort Lauderdale strip joint, and the two quickly fell in love and became inseparable. Durbal also found out that Griga occasionally hung out at Solid Gold Strip Club, scouting models for his phone line advertisements. It didn't take long for Beatrice to be completely weirded out by Durbal. He wanted to know so much about Frank Griga. He had weapons and supposedly unlimited money, even though he worked at a gym. So Beatrice is like, okay, the math ain't math in here, and you're being real weird. She's like, unless you're writing a book about Frank Riga, stop asking me about him.
And by the way, you're not.
Right. He tried to feed her the CIA line, but she wasn't buying it. So she broke things off with him. But he didn't care because by that point, he had an in with Griga. Attila Weiland, Beatrice's ex-husband, was going to help Dorval get a meeting.
Wait, does he know what's going on? No.
No. Beatrice knows that, like, Attila Weiland is also her ex-husband, is also trying to get a meeting with Frank Griga because he's, like, a massive businessman. So he also had, like, a little man crush on him. And then also, Dorval was obsessed with him. So she's like, literally go talk to my ex-husband. I don't care about you. Leave me alone. And so, you know, Dorval is like, hey, man, how do you know Frank Griga? Let's talk about
it. Hey, Eskimo bros.
Exactly. Yeah, all three of them. Dorval and Lugo knew they needed help getting to Griga. So they asked Big Mario once again, who like helped them get Mark Schiller, and they paid him $1,000 for that. But he said absolutely not. He wanted nothing to do with something like that. So he said no. And they asked Carl Weeks as well, but he also declined. So Lugo turned to Sabina to help him with their undercover CIA mission. Sabina was excited about the assignment. She felt like she was displaying her patriotism. Lugo filled her in. They would snatch Griga and his girlfriend from Griga's mansion. And after Lugo and Dorval entered the front door, Sabina would wait until she saw the garage door open and Dorval driving a Lamborghini out into the driveway. Then she would back Lugo's gold Mercedes into the garage. Griga and the girlfriend would be stashed in the trunk of the Mercedes, and they'd be handcuffed, gagged, tranquilized, and blindfolded. He told her she'll be scared when it happens, but everything is going to be fine and they're okay. She was concerned that they were taking his girlfriend because she didn't do anything, but he told her if they leave her, she'll talk, but they won't hurt her. Attila Weiland told Frank Griga that he knew a couple of guys who wanted to pitch a business deal, and Griga agreed to listen. The next day, Lugo and Dorval showed up at Griga's mansion dressed the part. They wore tailored suits and ties, and Dorval even wore Mark Schiller's presidential Rolex. Griga had been wearing a t-shirt and shorts, and was definitely impressed with the two. Lugo did the talking, explaining that he and Dorval were offering a lucrative investment opportunity through Interling International Incorporated, which was actually a legitimate telecommunications company expanding into India. He gave Griga legitimate brochures and had pie charts and a whole presentation and told him they were seeking only serious investors. He'd have to chip in between $500,000 and $1 million to get in. And Griga was interested. He might even want to invest more than a million. As a bonus, Christina, his wife, gave Lugo and Dorval a guided tour of their mansion, which was a perfect ending to their visit. On the way home, Dorval was psyched. Once they arrived home, Lugo told Sabina that the abduction of the Golden Beach couple would go down tomorrow. That evening, she watched in her living room as Dorval and Lugo packed their FBI equipment, guns, handcuffs, rope, syringes, and Rompin, which was a horse tranquilizer. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it was a tranquilizer for large animals. On the way to Griga's home the next day, Sunday, May 21st, they realized they had forgotten duct tape, so they had to stop off at a store, and Lugo turned to look at Dorval, who was entering the store, and shrieked and scrambled out of the car because Dorval's gun was clearly visible and sticking out of the back of his pants, which would have been a problem. But after that slight hiccup, everything was great. They even listened to Life in the Fast Lane as they drove through the security gate of Frank Griga's mansion. Sabina waited anxiously for them in the car after they went inside, imagining their plan unfolding. But to her surprise, they came out empty-handed. Dorval was angry they didn't do it, but Lugo said the timing wasn't right. So they invited Griga and Christina to dinner that evening. They could meet at Shula's Steakhouse. However, that was a mission abort as well, because Lugo and Dorval got into a fight. Over the next few days, Griga studied the Interling International corporate information package, and he decided that he'd meet again with the men. At about 8 p.m. on May 24th, 1995, Lugo and Dorval showed up at the Griga home to accompany them to dinner. After a night of schmoozing with friends of the Grigas, they finally got the couple alone once again, this time at Dorbal's townhome. As Lugo and Christina watched television on Schiller's stolen TV, Dorbal and Griga went into another room to talk business. But soon enough, even Schiller's surround sound speakers couldn't muffle the noises coming from the next room. There was a loud argument going on and crashing noises, so Christina ran to the back room with Lugo in tow. She found that her husband's head was bleeding above the ear after being hit with a hard, blunt object. As she looked around the room, she saw blood spattered the computer screen, the sliding glass door, and the walls. She watched in horror as Dorbal took Griga into a headlock and began strangling him. She screamed, but Lugo clamped his hand over her mouth and tackled her. She was handcuffed and her feet were bound with duct tape. They wrapped the tape over her eyes and mouth as well and injected her with the tranquilizer. She was unconscious within moments. They pulled a ninja hood down over her head, and for good measure, they gave Griga a hefty injection of the tranquilizer as well. After taking a breather and surveying this messy scene, Lugo and Dorbal checked on Griga, who would soon be hauled off to the warehouse where he would provide them with untold riches. At least that's what they hoped. But that's when they realized that they had overdone it. Griga was dead, and they hadn't gotten a single penny out of him. They still had Christina, who could provide information about the house and potentially their safe, so they dumped Griga into the bathtub, but she was still unconscious. So they called George Delgado, since he was supposed to help them that evening anyway. Delgado raced to the townhouse to help them with damage control. When he got there, the first thing he noticed was the temperature. It was as cold as a meat locker. They had the AC on full blast, because now they had a corpse. Christina was still unconscious, but she was their last hope. As she started waking up, they pulled back the duct tape from her mouth, but immediately she became hysterical, wanting to know where Frank was, so they gave her more tranquilizer. They yanked her into a sitting position and began to press her for answers, but in that state she didn't understand, and she didn't speak much English as it was. Finally, she gave them some slurred numbers that they wrote down on a yellow legal pad, and they injected her with more tranquilizer. Lugo picked up Sabina, and the two went to Griga's house to try out the code, but soon found out that this code didn't work, and on top of that, Christina was now dead, so they would never get a dime out of either of them. Lugo was furious, so he grabbed the contents of Griga's mailbox before driving Sabina home and then meeting back up with Dorbal and Delgado. They had to get rid of these bodies, but they needed a good plan, so they slept on it. Dorbal slept in the house with the two corpses. Could you actually imagine being like, yeah, you know, we need to get rid of these bodies, but let's just figure it out in the morning?
No, I can't imagine killing anyone.
No, but, obviously, you know, not. But like, also, like, I just being in the same...
Also being so nonchalant about it.
Right. So anyway, the next morning, Delgado rented a white van while the other two went to Home Depot to buy supplies. And after buying everything at Home Depot, their total was $666.
That's funny.
Which is telling.
How much shit did they buy?
Oh, they bought a lot of shit.
Almost $700 in 95.
Yeah, well, they bought a lot of stuff. Yeah, like buckets and duct tape and a machete and a chainsaw.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Dude, can you imagine being the cashier?
That's what I was thinking. When I read the list of the shit they bought, I was like, bro, this is
Did
not...
somebody call the cops? Like, this no. is so obvious.
No. Yeah, they bought literally everything in one go at one store, and it was as unbelievable as you could imagine.
I'm sure he had an excuse for it. We're in the CIA.
Yeah, right.
Shopping at Home Depot.
Right. Put it on the company card. They hand over Mark Schiller's credit card.
Yeah, like he's an undercover agent. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
So after that, they transported the bodies from Dorbal's home to the van and then to Delgado's warehouse. And at the warehouse, the trio would eventually end up dismembering the bodies of Frank Griga and Christina Furtin. And as we talked about in the beginning, there was a movie made about this story called Pain and Gain. And this scene in the movie was very graphic and disappointing, to say the very least, because they tried to make it funny. Like, the three of them dismembering a body, two bodies, in a very brutal, disgusting way. They made it a comedic moment, and it goes on for a very long time and is pretty close to what they actually did to their victims. But in reality, it was actually worse, which is surprising having seen that moment in the movie.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they kind of made a joke of like, oh, you do it. No, you do it.
Yeah.
And then one of them was like, I'll do it. Like, whatever.
Yeah. They're taking like the dismembered, they're taking like the dismembered body parts and like, it's just ridiculous. Like, yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to go into specifics about how they mutilated these bodies, but it's really nasty and awful. So, and it was ridiculous. They ended up having to go back and forth to Home Depot because their chainsaw had broken, and they sprayed and wiped the bodies down with Windex to take off any fingerprints. They had snack breaks. And after being left alone with the bodies, Lugo had taken their hands and feet and various skull portions and was burning them outside on a grate on top of a barrel, which was insane because anyone could have driven down the street and seen him. So Delgado took him inside with the burning barrel. It was as if he was like grilling on a grill at a barbecue. They ended up putting the bodies in drums that they welded shut and dumped at a drainage ditch in Southwest Miami. So just very over the top and ugly. At Dorval's townhouse, Delgado and Lugo met with some maintenance workers to have them help with the floor, which had large chunks taken out of it since they said a feral cat had wandered in and peed all over the place. In reality, it was chunks of the floor they had pulled out because of the blood spatter that had been on them. But, you know, they didn't need to know that. Adrian Dorval had gotten back together with Cindy, the nurse, and the two were actually engaged at this point, so she was helping them as well. He had told her that there was a couple or like a fight that had broken out in their house, which explained the blood, but left out the key detail that they had killed people. So she was actually helping them like clean up the blood and like painting over blood spatter on the walls.
That's insane.
Yeah. She didn't know the extent of what had happened. All she knew was that she didn't want Adrian getting in trouble. So she helped. After getting married, Dorval got a call from Attila Weiland, Beatrice's ex-husband, who had initially arranged the meeting with Frank Griga. The cops were breathing down his neck, and he told them everything about what he knew, which wasn't much, but still, he said everything about how he introduced Adrian Dorval and Danny Lugo, and he, you know, got them a meeting with Frank Griga and blah, blah, blah. So the police presumed that the couple was dead, and now they had Dorval and Lugo's names. Frank Griga and Christina Furton had been missing for 8 days by the time private investigator Ed Dubois got a phone call from Captain Al Harper, who he had asked for help with the Mark Schiller kidnapping. He had recognized the names, and he called Dubois. So Dubois had to talk to the homicide team supervisor, Sergeant Felix Jimenez, who was in charge of this case. This was obviously a lot of information, but he was at the very least glad that the Schiller investigation was coming back to life. And he thought to himself, if more cops had listened to him sooner, these deranged freaks wouldn't have had a chance to strike again.
Hard to argue with that.
Yeah. Dubois explained how he'd offered the information and documents to Metro Police in April, only to be blown off. Jimenez's department had had this information for 6 weeks and had sat on it. Now they were dealing with another terrible tragedy, and this time the victims had been killed. They called Mark Schiller and asked if he could come back from Columbia to help. On Friday, June 2nd, Mark Schiller returned to Miami. It had been nearly 2 months since his last visit to police headquarters. This time, he told his story to Sergeant Felix Jimenez, the lead investigator of this new case. This time, no one suggested he was lying, and no one dared ask him to take a polygraph. And he told them everything. He had recognized George Delgado and Danny Lugo's voice, but Adrian Dorval, Lillian Torres, and John Meese were also involved. In the meantime, Lugo and Dorval were losing their minds because they knew the police had their names and things were not looking good for them. They were flailing. And Cindy Elridge, Dorval's now wife, was sick to her stomach about it. She knew there had been a fight in their townhome, but she didn't realize that someone had died. And after seeing the news about this missing Hungarian couple, she began putting the pieces together. She asked Adrian what had happened to the girl because she was terrified, and Dorval told her what she didn't know wouldn't hurt her. The next morning, the Metro Dade police gathered, including 75 officers, SWAT teams, and hostage negotiators who were ready to serve search warrants at the homes of Daniel Lugo, George Delgado, and Adrian Dorval. As Cindy sipped her coffee in her nightgown, police swarmed their townhome, and Dorval left with the police just to answer some questions, according to him. Delgado had begun talking already, saying yes, he hired Lugo to collect the money Schiller owed him, but Lugo got carried away. When his lawyer showed up, he declined to speak any further. Dorval admitted his participation in Schiller's abduction, but then stopped talking. His last comment was, "I'll never see daylight again." John Meese was also promptly arrested at his National Physique Committee's Florida Men's State Championship competition. Say that 10 times.
Yeah, also probably one of the most entertaining events they'll ever have.
Yeah, I mean, imagine getting arrested at a bodybuilder competition. Like, Mr. Florida.
Like, everyone's like, is this part of it?
Yeah, it's not. Officers discovered that Daniel Lugo had already fled to the Bahamas with Sabina and his parents. But Sabina had left Diana Schiller's BMW in the apartment's assigned parking space. 5 days later, a multi-agency task force flew to the Bahamas, and they found Lugo at a hotel and brought him back in handcuffs to Miami on a commercial flight. And as the plane landed, he saw all the police cars waiting for him on the tarmac, and he couldn't believe that was all for him. Adrian Dorval sat in his jail cell and watched on the news that Daniel Lugo had agreed to take the police to the bodies of Frank Riga and Christina Furton. He had agreed if the police would mention his helpfulness to a jury during any potential criminal proceedings. An agreement was drawn up and signed by Lugo, his lawyers, the police, and the state attorney's office. The police were stunned when they found the state of the bodies, but Lugo declined to help any further. During the summer and fall of 1995, police made more arrests. Carl Weeks and Stevenson Pierre, who'd participated in the Schiller abduction, were arrested. And Sun Gym owner John Meese, who had been released after his initial interrogation, now found himself in police custody once again. So did Lugo's mistress, Sabina, and Cindy Ulridge faced charges too. The cops went after minor players as well. Little Mario Gray, who had helped dump the bodies in their barrels in the channel, a Sun Gym member who'd altered the information and numbers on Diana Schiller's BMW, a former trainer at the gym who had been paid to be an intimidator during the Schiller kidnapping, aka Big Mario. However, they all cooperated with police and received relatively light sentences, ranging from a year of probation to 2 years in prison, depending on the charge. Prosecutors also struck deals with Weeks and Pierre, who told all they knew about the Schiller affair and were let off with 10-year sentences, which is pretty light considering what they did.
Yeah.
On March 27, 1996, a Dade County grand jury returned a 46-count indictment against the leaders of the Sun Gym gang for conspiracy to commit the murders of Frank Riga and Christina Furton and the kidnapping, extortion, and attempted murder of Schiller. George Delgado was the first of the major defendants to crack. He gave a confession to Assistant State Attorney Gail Levine and in turn received just 15 years for the Schiller crimes and a concurrent 5-year sentence for his role in the Griega Furton case. It was a sweetheart deal for the state's star witness. Prosecutors were unable to link him to the plot and violence against Frank Griega and Christina Furton, only as an accessory after the fact. But he could testify about what had happened to the couple in Dorval's townhouse and at the warehouse. So Cindy filed for divorce.
Yeah.
She and Dorval had only been married for 4 days, which she now realized had been a complete farce with the sole purpose of inhibiting her from being able to testify against him. So he was like, "Let's get married." And she's like, "Great, let's do it." And then she realized that it was because he didn't want her to testify against him. So she pleaded guilty to criminal mischief, a misdemeanor, and agreed to reveal all she had heard and seen. Lugo and Dorval's trials were really interesting because they had two juries, one to listen to the case against Lugo and the other to hear the evidence against Dorval and Meese. And the trials would happen simultaneously in the same courtroom.
What?
So Lugo, Dorbal, and John Meese were all being tried simultaneously in the same courtroom with two separate juries. So there were times where, like, Dorbal and Meese's jury had to, like, step out, or Lugo's jury had to step out because they couldn't hear certain things, but they were happening at the same time in the same courtroom.
That's so interesting.
I know.
Do you know why they did it that way?
Probably because it was all so tied together that they were like, yeah, let's just do this all now. Like,
I guess so.
I don't know.
But is it because you need... I mean, I guess it is weird that they didn't have three...
Yeah, I don't know why Dorbal and Meese were kind of lumped together.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if it was like, well, this costs a lot of money and, you know, whatever.
I wouldn't be that surprised, to be honest. It does kind of make sense that they would have it all together, because it's a lot of evidence to be presented at multiple trials, you know?
That's true. But I kind of always imagine that everyone's tried like one at a time with their own jury.
Yeah, I feel like typically that is the case, but...
So, I wonder what happened.
Not this time. The trial began on February 24th, 1998, and for nearly 10 weeks, the prosecution laid out its case. It was the longest, most expensive criminal trial in Dade County history, and featured more than 1,200 pieces of physical evidence and 98 witnesses, including Mark Schiller.
This is why they lumped them together.
Yeah. When the prosecution rested, Lugo and Dorbal's attorneys chose not to present a defense. And John Meese's public defender just called one witness, and none of the defendants took the stand.
Wow.
Yeah. On May 4th of that year, Lugo's jury convicted him of the two murders, as well as 16 other charges, including racketeering, kidnapping, attempted extortion, theft, attempted murder, armed robbery, burglary, money laundering, and forgery. Dorbal also was found guilty of the two murders, plus 13 additional charges. On June 1st, Dorbal's jury deliberated just 14 minutes before they recommended the death penalty. And a week later, Lugo's panel voted for the death penalty, and it took them all of 18 minutes to decide.
It's hard to imagine how short of a time that is, given the volume of evidence that they were presented.
Which is saying a lot,
right?
I feel like.
I mean, you think about how long did this trial take?
I don't know off the top of my head, but they had 1,200 pieces of physical evidence and 98 witnesses.
Yeah, so how could you possibly remember all of that?
They didn't really have to. They were like, well...
Exactly. You know what
like
I mean?
15 minutes in and out, we're good. Yeah, death. Like, these guys suck.
Yeah, but I don't know. I just imagine the way that a jury will usually deliberate is that they like go back and review.
Because right.
Like, how can you remember everything?
Yeah.
And I just did not
Wasn't the
do
case.
Any of that.
Yeah.
I actually wonder what they talked about for 18 minutes.
They're probably like, we can't go back in immediately, right?
Yeah, do you guys want to take a beat, like a coffee break?
Like, yeah, what if
everyone's
we just
on the same page?
Had a bathroom break and then we go back in?
Yeah, they honestly might have debated death penalty versus life.
Yeah, probably. But also, it wasn't them, like, he wasn't sentenced at that point. It was just like they recommend the death penalty. They found him guilty and they said, yeah, he probably should be sentenced to death.
Yeah.
So anyway, John Meese was convicted on 39 felony counts, including two counts of first degree murder, attempted murder, racketeering, and multiple counts of money laundering, fraudulent notary, and forgery. On the eve of the trial, the prosecution had offered him a plea bargain of 9 years in state prison. He'd already served 2.5 years in the county jail since his arrest, but he rejected that deal, and instead, he ended up being sentenced to 56 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when I heard the deal, I was like, yeah, that's a no-brainer.
You would think.
You have 39 counts. You're tied to murder.
Mm-hmm. And like so much more than just that too, but like murder's huge. Oh, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it's the biggest one.
Yes.
And you essentially get 7 years out of it.
Yeah. And then he rejected it and got 56 instead.
Wow.
Talk about regret, right?
Yeah.
Like, goddamn. Dorbal had attempted to marry a secretary that he had been seeing throughout his incarceration because he still had $700,000 of Schiller's money. And apparently that would like help him keep it, or it would like slow down the process of having him give it back. But the judge denied that marriage to help with the transfer of funds back to Schiller, which is good.
Right.
When the jury's death penalty votes came in, prosecutor Gail Levine invited Schiller back to Miami for the final round of arguments before Judge Furrer, whose duty it would be to make the final determination on the recommendations, officially sentenced them. At long last, it was Schiller's time to stand before his kidnappers, who sat shackled and handcuffed. He spoke eloquently and in agonizing detail of the weeks he'd spent in captivity, handcuffed and blindfolded. He spoke of his family's sufferings and the scars he still held, the kidnappings and the torture that had ruined him in every way imaginable. He could no longer visit clients. He could no longer trust a soul in this world. His wife, a frail woman to begin with, was now in failing health and a mere 84 pounds. How could human beings commit such heinous crimes? He would never understand, but he knew one thing. Neither man, not George Delgado either, deserved to live in society again. It was a mic drop moment. Once outside of the courthouse, while he was walking down the steps away, Schiller paused when he heard men's voices shouting after him, telling him to stop. Puzzled, he turned just as they closed in around him. Panic surged, and for the second time in his life, Schiller was grabbed and taken away. The news broke all over Miami later that day. Mark Schiller was a wanted man. FBI agents arrested Schiller on charges of orchestrating a fraudulent Medicare billing scheme that generated somewhere around $14 million. He now faced up to 25 years in prison, 10 years more than his nemesis Delgado had received for the kidnapping and murder.
Wow. Oh my God.
He now knew that the assistant state attorney, Gail Levine, had sold him out. Like I think she was a woman, but she was like, come back for the sentencing. And his attorney even advised him not to go back, meaning Schiller's attorney was like, there's no point for you to go back. Like the case is closed. They're getting the death penalty. You do not have to go there. And he went just because he's like, I'm really going to make sure they get it. And then he was arrested.
Wait, so he was living in Colombia?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would they not have gone to Colombia to get him?
Probably not. Wow. I mean, he wasn't like wanted for murder. Like it was $14 million. So that's a lot. But like, he probably couldn't step foot back in the U.S. again, but they're not going to come after him, probably.
Wow.
For 3 years, she had used him, forced him to relive every excruciating detail of his confinement. The starvation, the burns, the electrical shocks, the beatings, the absolute physical and psychological mortification, and had extracted everything she could, and then she disposed of him. On July 17th, 1998, more than 3 years after the murders were committed, Judge Furrer finally sentenced Lugo and Dorbal. They each received 2 death sentences for the murders of Frank Riga and Christina Furtin, and consecutive sentences for all the other crimes for which they had been convicted. And Mark Schiller had to hear about this from jail. In February of 1999, after Mark Schiller pleaded guilty to 1 federal count of false Medicare billing, the judge took a highly unusual step of providing favorable testimony at his sentencing hearing. He basically said, like, you've been to hell and back and were extremely helpful in getting these guys behind bars, so I'm going to be as lenient as possible with you. And on Wednesday, March 17th, Mark Schiller was sentenced to 46 months in prison, the most lenient sentence available under federal guidelines. So he did end up going to prison for 46 months, but, you know.
You still went to prison.
Wasn't 25 years.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of fair. You did defraud the government.
Sure.
Of $14 million in 1994. But yeah, I mean... he was irreparably just mangled during that torture.
I mean, sure, fraud is not great. $14 million is a lot of money.
I mean, he was essentially stealing it.
Yeah, that's a big sum of money to be, you know, doing that. But also, he went through the worst possible thing. Like, he was literally held captive and tortured and almost murdered. Like,
yeah.
I feel like that's punishment. He got his punishment.
Yeah.
Kind of. Like,
yeah.
In my opinion, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I see that argument.
Yeah. But... Which, I mean, that was how the judge felt as well. He's like, yeah, right. Like, we got you, but also I'm going to give you.
Bad.
Yeah. I feel really bad, and I'm going to give you the smallest sentence I possibly can. So, you know, he did end up going to prison, but he got out of prison in 2001 and he wrote a memoir and found out about the Pain and Gain film, which was directed by Michael Bay and starred Mark Wahlberg and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And he could not believe the way he was portrayed in the movie, because he was portrayed as like a really just slimy, like unpleasant businessman. And the movie almost made it seem like, not that he deserved to be tortured and murdered, but like you didn't feel as bad for him because he was so terrible. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it was every stereotype of a kind of pompous, slimy businessman you could kind of grab onto.
Right. Like you were almost rooting for the Sungjim gang in the movie. At least like that's how they were playing it. You know, like, yes, you can understand that they're like terrible people like doing crimes, but there are so many movies and TV shows where you're rooting for the bad guy, and like they kind of made it like you were rooting for them.
Yeah.
So that was...
It was also like over the top.
Yes, very over the top. Yeah, I mean, it was made to be like a dark comedy, which again is just insane to me.
The only argument I could think of in favor of the movie for the way that they did it would be that they kind of wanted to make a point about how nonchalant and flippant these thugs were during the torture.
Yeah.
That it seemed like it was, you know, more, it was lighter just because they literally didn't care about anything.
Yeah, sure. I can understand that. Again, I can understand that this story is so ridiculous on so many levels that it does suit itself well to being a movie, but I just feel like they were very careless with like the treatment of the actual victims of the story and like the survivor and the couple who was murdered, like Frank Riga and Christina. They did not deserve the treatment they got in that movie. Like that was disgusting. So honestly, I would not recommend it. I wouldn't go watch it again. Like it was...
Yeah, I don't think I would watch it again either.
Yeah. So anyway, take that with a grain of salt, I guess.
Yeah, no, this is a weird... We're like doing a...
Movie review?
We're doing a movie review.
Well, we had, you know, 25 pages of other notes as well. But, you know, it's relevant because it's about this story. And I don't know. It's like the negative side of things like this, where it's like they just take it and they make a complete mockery out of it. And it's like, it's real people. So it's tough. And Mark Schiller was like, I am not that person. Like he said, there is no resemblance to me at all. I was always a humble family person. So like, if that really is the case, which I believe it to be true, the way they portrayed him in the movie is just like so shitty. Like it's so terrible. Imagine being that person and watching your like biggest trauma ever play out. And you're like portrayed as this like shitty asshole and you're like not.
Yeah. And then they try and like make it somewhat fun.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would... I'm sure the torture was way worse, but this is just a cherry on top.
Right.
Yeah, I hope he made more money off the book.
Yeah, me too. And yeah, he's now out of prison, thankfully. I mean, this happened all in like 1998, so he's out. And I believe Delgado is out as well. But Lugo and Dorbal, as far as I know, are either still on death row or I don't know. But
what about Meese?
I think Meese probably got out. Oh, no, 56 years.
56. I mean, they probably put him up for parole in, I don't know, 25?
I didn't find any information on Meese, so it's very possible he's still behind bars.
Yeah. I don't know. I would bet he's probably paroling, like, getting close to where they're like, ah.
I don't know. Anyway, that is the ending of part two of the story of the Sungjim gang.
I really wasn't prepared for how much information this was going to be.
Yeah, I wasn't either, to
but
be honest.
I did not feel bored at any point. Like, it was just all so much, but all so unbelievable and unique. Like, the fact that multiple police... I mean, I'm not calling the FBI a police department, but, like, multiple authorities...
Yes.
...completely dismissed this case.
Yeah.
Just on its face.
Yes.
Because it sounded ridiculous. That is so crazy to me. And then even the detective who was in robberies after it was shuffled around followed up on it, like verified that it was
fishy
and tracking. And she believed that criminal wrongdoing had taken place.
Yeah.
And she just sat on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know that detectives do that.
I mean, not good ones.
I mean, yeah, I guess it's one thing if you run into a dead end mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm sure there's other cases to be solved.
Yep.
Or things you could actually make a difference for.
Sure.
But it was actively having many leads.
Yes. And she like did not interview any of the people that she had as like suspects. Like, it was all lining up. And then she's like, actually, I'm busy with other stuff.
Yeah. Like, what?
Yeah. And Dubois even followed up with her and was like, hey, girl.
What's going on?
What's up? And she's like, no, don't tell me what to do. That was the other thing. Like, yeah, I mean, completely tied to what you're talking about. I couldn't believe that Ed Dubois, who had such a well-respected, long career in his private investigating and like helped out multiple police agencies and like the FBI on many different cases. And he comes to them with like a lot of evidence. And they all were like, no. Like, yes, I can understand that this story is unbelievable. And like, honestly, I've never heard anything like it. So I get that part. But also, like, from a respect level, like, this is a very well decorated, well accomplished detective. Like, give him a little bit more respect on his name. You know what I mean?
Yeah, also, like, you wouldn't even really have to give him that much respect. You just have to look at the evidence.
The mountains of evidence he's already collected.
Like, he solved already, the case for you.
Literally. Yeah, it's like all you have to do is just go arrest these terrible people and you did it. Like, he did it.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, yeah, I don't know what else to say about it. It's just all so ridiculous. And I'm glad that they got the sentences they got.
Yeah. But yeah, I never thought we'd be reviewing a movie or kind of shitting on it.
Yeah.
In this podcast.
I know.
But yeah, it was a little distasteful, perhaps.
Not only that, I just didn't really like it that much, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, sorry. Anyway, so why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser and you can tell me something good so we can go on with our days as normal. What's your good thing?
My good thing is that I have a trip to Europe.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I am going to Zurich to visit some bros.
Let's go.
Long lost. Just a college friend who decided to move to Zurich and work there. For the past, I think, 2 years, maybe three.
It's so cool that you get to just like go to Switzerland and hang out with your friend who lives there.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I haven't seen him in so long, so I'm really excited to catch up. But
yeah,
I'm pumped for the trip. It basically is our tour guide,
mm-hmm.
and that's fantastic for me because I'm lazy and want to be shown around.
Well, you're not going to be lazy on the trip because you're going
a
three-day like, hike through the Alps?
Yeah, like once I'm there, I'm not lazy.
Yeah.
You know, but for whatever reason, planning is always there's some mental block for me. I hate it.
Sure. Planning a trip is not like a easy thing to do all the time. Like it's pretty, a lot of moving parts, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm pumped for that. What's your good thing?
That's great. My good thing is that my friends from home are coming to visit our new place in Michigan, and we're going to do a little tailgating and have a fun time together.
So we're becoming a makeshift hotel.
Yes. Motel. For one weekend and one weekend only, we will be a house of seven.
I know.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is really feeling like the college days.
Yeah, it's gonna be giving college for sure. But no, it'll be fun. I can't wait to see them and I can't wait to show them around and tailgate with them and just have a generally silly time. So it's gonna be good. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get access to the bonus episode that came out this week, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We have a new merch shop where you can get all your Not Today accessories and merch. And the link will be in the episode's description and in our bio over on Instagram, which is nottoday_podcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listener's episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.